Lend me your ears. The Studio. Courses and masterclasses.
Welcome back to Decolonizing the Voice. Please find yourself a comfortable, settled place as you take part in a brief writing exercise in response to the questions that will follow about the sonic materiality of your voice. First, though, just a brief introduction. Podcasts 1 to 5 touched on subtle variations of the same idea, that the voice is comprised of a profound mix of personal, physiological, social, and cultural factors, and that it is never one thing. We found it very helpful to consider that the voice is always in a state of being formed. No sooner sounded than it shifts again due to the influence of another set of variables. There is never just one fixed moment we can call the voice, but a series of ever-changing vocal signals that spring from different intentions and receive different responses. This podcast asks that you reflect in detail on the tonality of the voice and the tunes or melodies it gives rise to. It's important, of course, to clarify what the term tone refers to, as it has arisen more than once in the previous podcasts. Gillian Kayes, in her book This Is a Voice, defines tone as being the same as the term timbre, which she defines as, quote, the quality and tone of voice used when we speak and sing, denoting mood and emotion, end quote. With this in mind, then, we can consider that the tone of the voice conveys not just the emotions and mood of the speaker, but also the social, cultural, and physiological memory. This broadcast, then, is interested in exploring the ways in which tonal qualities in the voices we hear have an impact on the voices we express. We suggest it's important to challenge and resist dominant cultural vibrations, particularly in relation to the marginalised voice. As US scholar Nina Eidsheim says in her article about the pitch of the voice, it is subject to literal social restrictions. By means of the exertion of social pressures that can reach into the physical, fleshly and skeletal arrangements of the body, the tone of the voice gets subject to social constructions. They literally shape us. Poet Selina Nuulu goes on and writes about the importance of better understanding how society imposes its dominant values on our own vocal shape and how resistance to those values, where they damage our individual capacity, is critical. She writes, and I quote, "To understand the sweet spot between the personal and the political, how to talk about something difficult in a way that is engaging." She goes on, "My motivation is to talk about politics, race, climate change, the social injustices that surround us, but in a way that is beautiful and personal." In the hard work to decolonize the voice, Nuulu's words are important to hold on to.
The recording you're about to hear is a poem titled A Strange Kind of Beauty, written and spoken by the young poet laureate Selina Nuulu in 2015.
Let's play a game. Let's peel back the skin of this city and rearrange its insides till we have created a strange kind of beauty we don't recognise. Let's move this city's landmarks like chess pieces. Take the London Eye and roll it to the edges of the city. Drag the Tate into Zone 5. Have the Royal Opera House playing in outskirt basement halls. Grab some chicken and chips via the London Coliseum. Classrooms become their own theatres so that young people can unfurl their aches into creative roars. For the shy ones, the pen becomes a microphone to their power, and those words travel further than the lulls of their stomachs. Instead, those notebook soliloquies become a future bouquet of verses blossoming into the mouths of thespians. Art galleries are not echo chambers of prestige. Instead, their doors have become a fleshy open smile, their tongues speaking in a language of visual miscellany. Graffiti masterpieces are hanging with Cezanne and Monet, their Rigdali moustaches on corridors twitching and beckoning young people to find new works of art to get lost in. Workshops are being run by Barker, wide floors and windows for children to paint on. Young people are composing digital sonatas in their rooms, and we've taken their roofs off. We've unplugged their headphones so that those t-t-t-t-t-t in their ears have now become a siren of noise. The sky has broken into an orchestra of patois symphonies. There's grime-fused electro sprinkled with classical undertones, rap lyrics chasing Bangra bouncing off of buildings. The sky, a new constellation of sounds pulsating like shooting stars across this city. Let's play this game. Let's play everywhere. Till we do not know where the highs and lows of this city begin and end. Till the backbone of London is a helix of hybrid noises, words, neon colours and shapes for young people to skip and dance across. So that wherever they go, their footprints will leave traces of the city they played in. So that wherever they go, they're left reeking with this strange kind of beauty. And they will not live less. They will not live less. They will not live less.
A Strange Kind of Beauty by Selina Nwulu, Young Poets Laureate for London 2015-16, is a poem commissioned by A New Direction, London's flagship cultural education agency, as a response to the challenges young Londoners face in engaging and contributing to the creative and cultural life of their city. In this poem, we can hear in her fantastical words the significance of a helix of hybrid noises, words, neon colours and shapes in the lives of young global majority Londoners. We hear in Wulu's personal and direct tone how a repositioned perspective, more relevant to a white, decentered view of the world, gives new shape to young Londoners' lives so that, open quote, wherever they go, they will not live less, and close quote. The fusion of personal tonality and imaginative content offers heartfelt resistance in the wider interests of decolonizing the voice. Next up, I have three questions for you to think about. How would you describe the tonal quality of the voices around you that have given you the most emotional support in your life journey? For example, I tend to respond to warm, clear, unintimidating, encouraging, and inspiring tones. A voice that holds me up and does not silence. Some people struggle to offer the tone of support, voices that don't oppress us. It is so easy for the voice to shift into an area of making someone feel downtrodden or oppressed. When I speak to certain people, that isn't always evident, and I don't always get the elevation that I need in that given moment. I tend to seek what I need from different sources. Certain people like friends, and believe that the impact on us is created by what we hear, who we speak to, and who we listen to. The sonics have an impact, and if I happen to not be feeling on top of it, I know who not to go to. After all, we are what we hear and receive. Question 2. How would you describe the quality of the voices around you that have given you the most courage? Question 3. How would you describe the voices around you that have given you the most inspiration? Now take a few moments to write down your thoughts about the questions I've just proposed to you. Please listen to the following examples of a range of tonal vocal qualities drawn from a variety of cultural backgrounds. Pick out your top three and write down some of the reasons why you have chosen them. Please use any terms that help you to define your choices about the tone of voice and, if it helps to use terms drawn from the field of voice, then that's great. Think about noticing any tonal features in the type of voice that impacts on you in a positive way, and those patterns and characteristics that sit more negatively. We might, for example, use terms that refer to features that are perceived to be warmer or harsher, sharper or softer. Try not to be too judgmental about your answers, but let them arise so that you can gain a deeper understanding about the ways in which you listen and respond to the voices around you, those close, those near, and those far. Next up is a selection of five recordings for you to choose your top three from. This first recording is of a poem written and narrated by award-winning South African theatre practitioner, slam poet and writer Koleka Patuma. In her powerful expression, it is apparent that her theatre context gives rise to a vocal range informed by a wide breadth of tonality, volume, pitch movement, and emphasis.
Hello. Thank goodness I'm not sharing a talk. This is how I articulate my ideas. I put them into poems and I hope that they make sense. The first poem that I'm going to be performing for you, it's a poem titled Stompies, and it's a poem that I was asked to write in response to a particular area in the northern suburbs, and it is for mothers who birth black sons and send them out into a society that still does not value their skin. They murdered their kingdom murals on a full moon, pounded their mother's wombs until they were tombs, and Lazarus became a man of fictional works instead of the miraculous. They sent their sisters spiraling through traffic, trafficked, missing, naive black sons ingested infected dumplings for bread and blood for gravy. They have been summoned here, banned there, missing. Every trail they leave dissolves to smoke. Things they bury, smoke. Glue sniffing from his steady stumpy cracked from crack, incubated in smoke, walking corpse to die, smoke, ashes. Unofficial metaphor for a black son. When asked, hey yo, what do you want to be when you grow up, son? They sigh, smoke. Answer, not a human being. History continues to evangelize that this air indeed belongs to them, to gamble, not breathe. They contemplating a matric, hustle and occupation that will build their beloved a house of bricks. But even that might turn to smoke, pot, hold, streets, make black sons believe they smoking pipe dreams with umbilical cords. How else? How else were those murals murdered? White paint over graffiti, all is well here.
In this next recording, by American poet and musician activist Gil Scott-Heron, it is notable that the influence of blues musicianship and the specific literary legacy of the Harlem Renaissance informs his rich spoken exchange with a live audience. He sounds tonally vibrant when speaking to the values of US Black literary inheritance, and vivid in his claims to its importance to his identity and that of other audience members.
So they come up to me, people come up to me sometimes and say, hey, read my poem. I read it. What now outside the wall, I see. And the only thing I can say to them is, hey, this must be deep. Because like being influenced by the kind of poetry that we were all introduced to, people feel as though like the way to be poetic is to make sure that there's certain little parts of it can't nobody understand. Why would you need a poet to make things more complex? Two winos can make things more complex. One of them say to the other one, well, is it best? Is that you? And the other one look at him right serious and say, yeah. And they communicated. You see, if communication is what it's all about, as far as most people sitting around watching, it could have been two poets talking to one another. They didn't have a clue. So the idea became not only to use ideas that were familiar to people in the community, but to use the language that everybody could understand. Of course, this poetry was always put down as street poetry because, of course, that's where the people were. People were on the street, and these were the people that you wanted to communicate with. Did an idea one time about how often it is that folks brother and sister one another, and how rare it is that something actually comes out of that that people can grasp onto. Did a poem about the fact that oftentimes the people who are doing the most talking and the kind of conversations that you run into around this neighborhood should be the ones doing the most listening. The poem we did was called Billy Green is Dead. The economy is in an uproar. The whole damn country is in the red. The taxi fares is going up. What? You say Billy Green is dead. The government can't decide on busing, or at least that's what they said. Yeah, I heard you when you told me. You said that Billy Green was dead. But let me tell you about these hot pants that this big leg sister wore when I was partying the other night. What? You say Billy took an overdose. Well, now, junkies will be junkies, but did you see Gunsmoke last night? Man, they had themselves a shootout and folks was dying left and right. At the end, when Matt was cornered, I had damn near give up hope. Why you keep on interrupting me? You say my son is taking dope. Well, then call the law and call the doctor. What you mean I shouldn't scream? My only son is on narcotics. Should I stand here like I'm pleased? Is that familiar, anybody? Check out what's inside your head, you see. Never seems to matter when it's Billy Green who's dead.
In this recording, we hear the racist tones of the media interview, in which it sounds as if Poitier is being hounded by the one-dimensionality of his interviewers, rather than being celebrated for his career. It is significant that the media sound attacking in their tone, monotoned, and Poitier sounds on the defensive tonality, not quite able to express the full range of his vocal capacity when he responds, why are you guys on hand for bad news? Reporters ask Sidney Poitier his views on race. 1968.
How close has my association been in the past with Dr. King? For some years now, I've worked raising funds for Dr. King, because I believe still very strongly in his non-violent philosophy.
What do you feel Ralph Brown's purpose is now?
I figured that question would come. I am not familiar with all of Mr. Brown's methods, except that Mr. Brown suggests violence. Well, I am, as by definition, in opposition to violence, particularly violence for violence's sake.
Do you think the urban riots have affected it, though?
I would say that the urban riots have had effects in every corner of the country and in every arena of life.
Do you feel it's creating?
I would like to ask you a question. Why is it that you guys are hounds for bad news? Why is it that You know, it seems to me that at this moment, this day, you could ask me many questions about many positive and wonderful things that are happening in this country. But we gather here to pay court to sensationalism. We gather here to pay court to negativism. You guys have a job to do. I'm a relatively intelligent man. There are many aspects to my personality that you can explore, I think, very constructively. But you sit here and ask me such one-dimensional questions about a very tiny area of our lives. You ask me questions that fall continually within the Negro-ness of my life. You ask me questions that pertain to the narrow scope of the summer riots. I am artist, man, American, contemporary. I am an awful lot of things, so I wish you would pay me the respect due and not simply ask me about those things.
In this clip, we hear the full richness of Shakespearean content meeting contemporary black vocality in ways that are reminiscent of the voice we heard earlier by Putuma in South African theatrical context. The theatre context seems to give permission for a fuller spectrum of tonality than that expressed in an ordinary spoken context.
Why do we let them determine the way we are regarded and responded to, before any assessment or interaction has taken place with our character? Where is that Martin Luther King, I have a dream ambition of judging a person solely according to the content of their character? So I'm sitting in London on the Victoria Line tube train, the underground, the metro, whatever you call it. I'm sharing these thoughts with my 18-year-old son. And he raises the idea of substance dualism. So, substance dualism. This is an idea developed by the 16th century French philosopher René Descartes. It's an idea that posits that the mind and the brain are two separate entities. Thank you, school AS-level religious studies. An idea of great interest to both of us, and perhaps the reason why my son is no longer in education, did not complete those AS level studies, and like many bright, articulate, transgender young adults, has fallen out of education completely. My son is a walking manifestation of substance dualism, of that looking out at a reflection of himself and seeing a girl's body staring back at him. An image his brain reports as faithful, but his mind, knowing it to be the wrong image, revolts against. A mind trapped in the wrong body.
In this final clip, we hear the tonal agonies present in the magnitude of racism in her performance of the poem Black Child. In the range of spoken sounds utilized, Pietas evokes a vocal resistance that reaches well above the bar of everyday conversation and evokes the realms of opportunity afforded by the mobilization of theatre actions.
A breathing piece of flesh with a colour that feeds into the colours of nature. Dark as the soil and colourless like the rays of the sun. A simple black child, a symbol of perfection. You can put it against the heat from the scorching sun, but its color will still remain unchanged. You can starve it, you can humiliate it, you can dishonor it, but it will rise and shine like a morning star. A simple black child, a symbol of perfection. Nature is the witness, and nature is the testimony. Nature proves that a black child is the resemblance of nature, and nature is the resemblance of a black child. A simple black child, a symbol of perfection. Your own shadow is the testimony of truth. The green trees, the white mountains of snow, the colorful flowers all have the dark shade like the color of a black child. A simple black child, a symbol of perfection. I did not make myself proclaim the black child. I am the work of art from the hands of God. I have a culture, your culture, my culture, my culture, your culture, your culture, my culture, my culture, your culture, because culture is nature, and nature is my resemblance. I am the resemblance of nature. You are the resemblance of nature. We are the resemblance of nature. You are the resemblance of nature. Come on. You cannot hate me. You can only love me because you love nature, and nature is my resemblance. Go on now, black child. Leave on and shine.
Think about the tonal quality in the voices that you have just heard as they set up specific kinds of vibrations and seem as if to enable different embodied sensations in you as you listen. Write down any standout observations about the following areas. A. Settled internal feelings of comfort and ease in the mind. B. Sensations of physical relaxation and restoration to support you in your day to day. C. Sensations of excitement on the breath that equate to curiosity and hope about the future.
Now you are experienced in noting down descriptions of the voices around you, we offer one final writing exercise where you can write down in your notebook the pitch, movement and emphasis patterns in your own voice. Think about your own spoken tune as if it were a melody or song, and allow yourself to let it go where it wants to, in a free-form way at this moment, without concerning yourself with communicating to anyone specific. Sing it out and enjoy sustaining it in ways that you wouldn't normally do in your spoken life. Now, draw your connections and links on a visual voice map, where colour and lines allow you to make visual comparisons and differences with the vocal patterns of two influential speakers in your life. Who are they in terms of the tune they bring? And can you identify anything about its movement as pitch that has stood out? Finally, write down any word associations that come to mind as you think about the voices that make you feel most vocally joyful and expansive, and reflect as to whether there's anything about these voices that allows you to feel vocally free.
Relax and notice the breath. Stretch and shake out and give yourself a few minutes to notice your feelings and sensations within the body before you go back to your day.
Lend me your ears. The Studio. Recorded as part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC Leadership Fellowship held by Dushka Radosavljevic at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.